Hello everyone, and welcome to another brilliant sport and lifestyle biz here on your Real Feel Good Radio, UK Health Radio. Well, unbelievably, it's the first week in December and we're already approaching Christmas and into 2023 with exciting times for us at the radio and sport and lifestyle biz. This week, we want to celebrate the last month of the year with the brilliant Mel Jones, all about cricket, how she got into it and how both her father and her mother helped her through the early parts of her life. Part one from Mel, part two next week. We hope you enjoy the show. You'll never stop this day. I will never let you go. Well, who am I to say? Maybe by now you should know. You got your somebody calling. You think you're somebody, don't you? I think you're scared of keeping somebody close. Yes, our interview is with the brilliant Mel Jones. Look out for some adverts in the middle of it. And also a music break with one of our favourite songs. Well, today, everybody, I'm joined by cricket superstar, not only on the pitch, but now from the commentary box, it's Mel Jones. Hi, Mel, how are you?
Superstar, I like that. I can handle that one.
You are.
Very well with an intro like that.
Brilliant. It's great to hear from you. Great that you're doing this for us. And yeah, you are. We'll come on to it a bit later in the interview, but you've got two successful careers, which is amazing. And you get paid to do what you love, which is even better. But just so the listeners get to know you a bit more, if that's okay, if I could just strip it back to the start. And you were born in England, moved to Australia when you were just 3 months old. So had an upbringing in the fabulous climate and culture, personally in sport, a winning culture. You don't see many Australians that don't fight tooth and nail. You were introduced to cricket at high school, but let us know how that came about and whether your love was instant or it grew on you.
Oh, yeah, really good question. I think so. My mum's Aussie. She's from a very small country town in Australia called Rutherglen, and she went to England to teach and travel, and she met my dad over there, and dad was from Trinidad. He moved over to England in the 50s. So yeah, born in Barnstable, it's where my mum was teaching at the time, but she was always planning on coming back home to Oz. So once she was fit to travel, the two of us got back, and look, my first touch point for cricket was like pretty much Australian, whether they played for Australia or not. Backyard cricket. It was in my grandparents' backyard with six male cousins who were all predominantly older than me, so I bowled a lot, didn't get to bat too much. But just fell in love with it because it was the pure element of play, you know. Yeah, it was a sport and it was competition, but you made up your own rules. You know, you couldn't hit Pa's chrysanthemums, his prized chrysanthemum flowers, or that, you know. You played all day. The only time you came in was probably to check out the cricket on Channel 9 at the time, you know, to have a bite to eat kind of thing. So it was just hours and hours of just pure enjoyment. So yeah, the love of the game started very early on.
That's lovely to hear. Two things that I'd like to pick up on. First of all, I've got family that live in Coombe Martin, which is probably about 12 miles from Barnstable. Quite bizarre. And more importantly, talking about cricket, a lot of the female footballers that I interview got love from playing with their siblings. But again, they were majority boys and they got stuck in goal. So it was quite interesting to hear that you just got bowling all the time.
There's a common theme, isn't it? And also because of, you know, mum and dad coming from two different countries, all the boys were always Team Australia and I was always Team West Indies.
Of course.
Point of difference too. So I actually grew up following the West Indies cricket team because Australia certainly wasn't the sort of multicultural place that it is now.
Right.
So, you know, I always grew up hoping I'd play for the West Indies or, you know, cheering on the West Indies rather than Australia.
Obviously two famous cricketing nations.
Yeah. 100%. Dad played a little bit of cricket in sort of middle six, not first class, lower grades, but he knew a lot of the West Indian cricketers, so he knew Malcolm Marshall and Joel Garner.
Wow.
And there was quite the cohort of West Indians back then. So whenever they toured, he organised tickets for me to go and watch them, and, you know, Wisden Cricket Magazine signed by them. So there was a real sort of connection to my dad. It was probably that connection that really kept me involved and loving the game as well.
And how amazing. I mean, two names you threw up there, a little bit like certain gentlemen we're going to perhaps talk about towards the end of the interview. Someone else that destroyed us, the English, yet we still managed to love.
Yeah. That's it. I think, look, to be honest, I think that's the beauty of sport. As much as you say that you're going to grow up and support a team, whether it's, you know, Chelsea in the football or, you know, Australia in the cricket, I think the beautiful part of sport is the theatre of it, isn't it? And you can appreciate skill and talent and entertainment. So even though that player might be on an opposing team, I think it's okay to say no, that you thoroughly enjoy watching them play or watching them play against your side.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what sport should be, you know, and how it should be watched and supported. So yeah, lovely words. Thank you. Going on to when you sort of started and perhaps had people to look up to, obviously your dad was a role model for you with the cricket, and you've mentioned some great names there that you probably looked up to. I can imagine you steaming into your siblings as Marshall or Garner when you were made to bowl. But anyone else you were looking up to, any other role models?
Well, it was tough back then because I didn't even know there was an Australian women's cricket team.
Right.
I sort of was going through school and started playing even club cricket, and they were world dominant back then. It's just that there was just no visibility of them whatsoever. So all my role models were either male cricketers or female athletes that I could sort of see myself in. And so it was people like Merlene Otte, who was, you know, a sprinter for Jamaica back in the day. I love Daley Thompson, who, you know, decathlete for England. So, you know, a lot of the role models for me in sport were people of colour, which meant that typically they were people from other countries as well. So it wasn't until I sort of got into senior club cricket and had a couple of Australian players at my club that I then recognised that there was an Australian women's cricket team. I mean, so Sharon Treadway was my idol growing up, Australian all-rounder, quick bowler. She played at my club and she was an absolute superstar Australian, Cricket Australia Hall of Famer now. So yeah, it wasn't until I really got into the system that I knew that there was some female cricketers to look up to.
Yeah, that's amazing to hear that, you know, it was totally invisible. Now being the best side in the world by, I think we can safely say, quite a long way, even if the gap is closing in a couple of areas. How did you make that jump, if it was invisible, from cricket at school to national team?
Yeah, luck. And I say that in a way, I don't like the elite athletes saying they were lucky getting picked for Australia, because there's a lot of hard work that goes into that. But the connection points were purely luck. Well, first and foremost, my mum, who's not a sports person at all, was my biggest supporter, and she drove me everywhere and did all the things that most athletes sort of talk about that their parents sort of gave up for them.
But yeah,
I went to a high school where I had a geography teacher. He was English, loved his cricket, and then got a girls' cricket team together for our school team. And he loved it so much, you know, he took us on trips to New South Wales and then off to New Zealand. And he got us linked in with local club sides.
Right.
Turns out, a few years after I left high school, he had a son late in life, and it was Peter Hanscom who ended up playing cricket for Australia.
Yeah.
As sort of the, you know, top order, middle order bat as well. So his dad was John Hanscom, my geography teacher. So I could have gone to a different high school, or he might not have taught there, but it was he and a PE teacher at the school, Deb Noonan, that were just, you know, put in above and beyond, really, to get us involved. So once you sort of get to a club, it becomes a little bit easier in the sense of you're sort of in a pathway and you can get picked up by state junior teams and the like.
They say things happen for a reason, and that's just, again, amazing,
isn't it? Yeah, the universe working in wonderful ways.
Especially, again, both of your sort of careers being in the sport, you know? Who'd have known? I mean, obviously you had cricket in you anyway because of, as you said, you were practising with family. But yeah, that's just brilliant. Lovely to hear. And again, as you said, the universe just working its magic almost. So that's brilliant. So you debuted for Australia in 1997. Obviously, that must have been fantastic for you. How did it feel when you first got to hear about it? And then when obviously you pulled on the colours or the whites?
Yeah, we just finished our state final series. So Victoria v New South Wales were at the SCG, which was huge for us because we never got to really play on the big grounds. And yet again, unfortunately, New South Wales had beaten us, so we're all a little bit in the doldrums, to be honest. And we were in the members' pavilion for the final function. And we sort of knew that the Australian team was going to get announced. I had no thought whatsoever that I was going to get picked. So I can vividly remember they had prawn cocktails there, and I'd never really had them before, and I was hoeing into this prawn cocktail when the Australian team was announced and missed my name getting called out, and people were like, "You just got picked." And I thought that they were taking the mickey out of me.
Right.
I'm like, "Don't be silly." I was too interested in my prawn cocktail at that time. So
priorities.
Everyone was just looking at me going, "You got to go up." Massive surprise. Couldn't believe it. I can remember getting to the airport still and physically introducing myself to players, because we just really never met, you know, you sort of play against them on the field, but that sort of it kind of thing. So it's a huge surprise, completely over the moon. Yeah, there's something very, very special. My first selection was for a tour. We didn't play a lot, still don't play a lot of test matches, so it was sort of all one days back at that stage. So the opportunity of, you know, pulling on the green and gold, which you sat back and you watched so many athletes through Olympic game, Commonwealth game, and Aussie teams do in the past. And yeah, to think that you actually had that tracksuit on now was something pretty special.
Lovely. Lovely to hear. And obviously you built a fantastic career. We're going to focus mainly on the test to start off with. Your first test was actually against the old enemy. It was against England, which is always a special match anyway. I think if you played Tiddlywinks, it would be a special rivalry. But not only did you play against England in your debut, you scored 131. How proud did that make you?
Yeah, look, it was an interesting test match. And finally, we were just chatting before we started this podcast, that you went to Guildford to watch one of your first women's cricket matches. And I reckon it was the same ground. It was sort of the Guildford main oval. Yeah. And look, to be honest, John, the pitch was a road. The only thing that was missing was probably the white lines down the middle of it. So I'd love to say it was a seaming deck and it was tough and it was hard. But you couldn't, as a batter, you couldn't have asked for anything better. But England had put on a good score. Jan Britton and Charlotte Edwards right at the start of her career.
Yeah.
And Jan Britton had a brilliant series. We just could not get her out. She was one of the all-time greats. And we were in a little bit of trouble early doors. We'd sort of lost Belinda Clark and Lisa Kightley early and Karen Rolton. And I'd got together with Joanne Broadbent in the middle order. And I do remember the night before saying, because I knew I was going to bat at some stage that day, the old saying, you only get one chance to make a good first impression. I thought, okay, Jones, you know, this is your opportunity. I knew we probably wouldn't play that many tests in my career. We had a three-match series for this one. And it was that, you know, the chance to actually pull on the baggy green, put on the vest with the coat of arms on it. There was all those little moments as you sort of build up to going out to bat. You sort of had to sort of just quash a little bit of it was just the excitement. You know, the heart rate sort of goes up.
Yeah.
It takes a while to sort of calm down. And we'd only played two-day cricket. It was the longest sort of format that we'd played getting ready for this test match as well. So that was sort of club cricket back home. So it really did test us because, you know, we hadn't played for that sort of length of time and trying to create and build an innings and understand the sort of the ebbs and flows of a test match innings. You're sort of learning on your feet quite a bit. So it sort of got through to the 90s and I sort of thought to myself, I haven't hit a century before. Because we'd played so much short format cricket.
Right.
And I was sort of middle order for Victoria back then. You know, I was batting six. I never really got the opportunity. I thought, this could be my first ever century. Which I thought was really, really bizarre that your first could be, you know, playing for your country. Yeah. And I hit, I reckon, it was two overs. I faced two maidens and I'd hit cleanly the ball to nearly every fielder on the ground. And my teammates, Julia Price, who is a really good mate of mine, was the wicketkeeper. She ran out of film almost. This is how old I am and how long ago it was. But it was the old time where you had 36 exposures and she, you know, was taking a photo nearly every shot.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
Nagging pain. We at Alka-Seltzer know that a small amount of the patient's own bone marrow and blood cells can treat many painful conditions with regenerative orthopedic therapy. This is an attractive treatment option for painful joints, back pain, sports injuries and many other conditions. It may avoid the need for surgery altogether. Alka-Seltzer, part of a network of 50 RegenX clinics worldwide where over 60,000 patients have been treated and helped. Alka-Seltzer. Life is more beautiful with less pain.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
Yeah, I can remember, like, I think about it now, and just that opportunity of, you know, sort of raising the bat and taking, you know, baggy green off. Yeah, not too many people get the opportunity of doing it. Yeah, it's something that'll live with me forever.
Oh, you know, it's amazing to hear, and it gives you chills, someone just talking about it, you know. The fact that you hadn't hit a century before, and obviously none of your doing it was the opportunity, because as you said, you only played 2-day cricket. The fact was you picked out every fielder, so I can imagine what was running through your mind. It's going to be one of them moments. So yeah, the fact that you did it, and obviously you've got the laugh about it at the end. Obviously not only is it a happy ending, you've got the laugh about it where your friend probably went through, as you said, three or four films to get the actual stroke. So oh no, that's
this is it.
Fabulous to hear. Honestly, fabulous to hear. You actually only played 5 tests again. Probably not any of your doing. It's probably just the lack of opportunity and overseas games that were played at the time.
Yeah, 100%. It was pretty much, it was Australia versus England. That was the only opportunity that you had to play any test matches. And then it came down to, we were all working full-time at the time. So that tour, 98, was about 6 weeks. I only remember people losing their jobs because they were taking so much time. You're taking leave. I was working part-time, so I could sort of negate that. But at the same point in time, you don't have any income coming in for 6 weeks.
Yeah.
So the tours were pretty much always designed around trying to cram in as many one-day internationals as you possibly could play. New Zealand never played test matches at that when I was playing, and still don't to this day, which is, you know, very sad and disappointing for the players there.
Yeah.
India weren't playing at the moment, or were very spasmodically. So, yes, you sort of, you know, over a 8-year period within the Australian setup to play 5 test matches is quite sad in one sense, but completely, you know, thoroughly enjoyable. And, you know, wouldn't change the fact that I got to play 5 test matches either.
And you said about cramming the one days in, which gives us a link to the next question about one day internationals. But I just want to finish off with a little stat, if that's all right, on your test career, because you played 5 tests, you got 251 runs, average of 35.85, 100 and 150, and I'm not buying they were all a road, because I guarantee in that test match you've just spoken about, not everybody got 131. So I just think that's fantastic. You know, you must sit back and look back at that and put a smile on your face.
Yeah, and I think of the enjoyment of test match cricket, it's hard for people that don't grow up on cricket, and I know a lot of your listeners are sort of, you know, football orientated sort of thing, probably are thinking, 5 days and there's no result, why on earth would you do it?
Why'd you do that?
Yeah, exactly. My mum still has no idea about it at all. It's just, I think for test match cricket for me, and there is still so much enjoyment and draw, because it does, it's why it's called a test. It tests you in every single way. Your game plan, your mental application, your skill, and it's every single delivery. And it can be in, you know, one of the 50 that I got was up in Sydney, and it was stifling. Sydney's a very humid city. We'd played in the Gabba the week before, and, you know, you're in 38 degrees with 90% humidity, and it's got to be switched on for every single delivery, whether you're in the field or batting or bowling. Yeah. And that is something with your mates as well, you know. It probably is the most individual team sport going around, because at that point of contact, it's, you know, the bowler versus the batter, but you're out there with your mates, and you getting other people through, or them getting you through, you know, tough moments is, you know, one of the beautiful parts of the sport that I love.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've hit the nail on the head there. It's called test match, and it does test you, which why I look at it as an outsider, if that makes sense. I play a little bit of cricket, you know, with the family or with my mate. I'm okay, but I'm not a cricketer, if that makes sense. But that's why, for me, you see all the best players performing consistently. Everyone's going to have a bad run. And then the players that are good, but you're unsure if they're test quality, play a good innings and have 3 or 4 bad ones. Do you know what I mean? But the top ones always come to the party when it's required.
Yeah, 100%. And I think when you look at the way cricket is at the moment, and, you know, there's so much talk and sort of investment in sort of the shorter formats in T20, you still look at T20 and the people that have dominated that, all those players have had magnificent test match careers. So if you go back, and Chris Gayle, if you talk about the men's side of it, because they've played more test matches, but Chris Gayle and Brendan McCullum, two that spring to mind, who everyone goes, oh, T20, that's all they've played on. You look at their test careers.
Yeah.
You know, double, triple hundred, they've hit a lot of balls. So their skill set and their ability to dominate the T20 game has come off the fact of, I personally believe, a love and a want and, you know, playing a lot of longer format.
I agree. Just from an England point of view, you look at T20 and the one-day internationals, and obviously being 50-over world champions at the moment. And even though, you know, the captain, Morgs, at the time, he came up with some good innings, and Roy and Butler and Bairstow, It was still Stokes that got him over the line, but the actual team was built around Joe Root's ability to bat 50 overs.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the way I see it. Everyone likes to go out and see sixes, but for England to be successful, they needed the Joe Root at the time, doesn't it? I mean, I think the game's moved forward again since then. So you're 100% correct, and it is the test players that actually excel at the shorter format as well.
It's for bowlers as well. Like, I look at Josh Hazlewood at the moment. He's, you know, predominantly been playing test match cricket for Australia, and he's the number one T20 bowler in the world at the moment. And no one would have ever thought that would have been the case.
No, you're right. And again, another great example and a lovely link into the other part of your career, which was the One Day Internationals. You played an amazing 61 times for your country and scored over 1,000 runs. I mean, how amazing is that?
Yeah, look, it's, you know, I look back on it, and it's funny when I look back on my ODI career, so many of the moments that sort of spring to mind aren't specifically about me and my batting. I don't know if that says a lot about my contributions to the team or not, but I played with an amazing era of players. So until this recent Australian team who went on a 26-game run, which is now the new world record across men's and women's, we held the record of 17 straight. And I played with some of the absolute superstars of the game, like Belinda Clark, who's ICC Hall of Fame, Lisa Kightley opened, who was...
She was England coach,
Shelley Nitschke, who's now coach of the Australian women's team. She played in it. Catherine Fitzpatrick was probably, you know, one of the fastest bowlers that the game's seen. It was Karen Rolton, ridiculously good. Like, it was just this unbelievably talented team. And so you were learning from the best in the business. It was training. You know, trainings were, you get in the nets and you're thinking, this is tough. You come out battered and bruised, but absolutely loving it. You know, we toured to India and to England. You know, in India we toured with trains, planes, automobiles. We're on overnight trains going places. So it was the adventures as well that you'd have that is so different to, you know, teams touring now with the flying business class and you know, got their own rooms and all this sort of stuff. It just wasn't the case back then.
No.
Lots of fun.
Yeah, and again, amazing. As I said, good stats in both of them. Obviously a very, very good career. We have just touched on the fact that you only played 5 tests because of the lack of opportunity, but it must make you very happy and perhaps ecstatic that the women's game is moving forward across the world. You know, there's obviously lots more to be done. And I interviewed Lizelle Lee about 3 years ago, just before COVID, and even South Africa were like, we don't really have any practice. Do you know what I mean? And I think the West Indies didn't have much practice either. Obviously, there's a lot more to be done, but it must make you happy seeing greater strides being made.
Yeah, it's one of those ones, John, where you kind of pinch myself daily on the fact that I'm still working and people are going to pay me to go around the world and talk about cricket and being able to be the women's game where it is at the moment. I mean, we've got some of the most talented athletes going around the game. You know, there's investment in them to actually see their absolute true potential, which is fantastic to see. You know, we've got emerging nations coming through. So it's not just Australia, England and India these days. You know, the West Indies are coming through. South Africa, as you mentioned, are coming through. Pakistan and Bangladesh, you know, almost the sleeping giants within women's cricket. You know, we're seeing things like paternal and maternal policies, which are allowing the likes of Lizelle Lee to stay in the game because there's support in and around athlete welfare and the like. So all those things you pinch yourself and go, I cannot believe that I started playing this game where I didn't know there was an Australian women's cricket team, to now people not just knowing the team, they can list off, boys and girls, list off all the players and their stats and all those sorts of things. So you do get buoyed by that. You know, ground's getting sold out. I was T20 Women's World Cup final at the G, you know, 86,174 people sitting there watching this magnificent game. So you get excited about it, but then also because of the advancement of the game, there's also still, you know, a variety of different pushback and backlash and you know, things where potentially the rush to push it forward, we just miss a few things. And so there's still a little bit of, I guess, frustration at times about where the game's going and who's controlling those decisions and the like as well. And I think that goes for women's football or any other women's sport where it's come through and there's still very much a men's lens administrationally on the decision making. And I'm still very cognizant of the fact that we still need to have some women's voices at the table to decide where the women's game is going.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point, you know, and it's almost like they almost have to be perfect when nobody's perfect, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, they do shoot themselves in the foot. There was an incident last weekend between England and India, which might not have been good for the game, which perhaps we can chat about a bit later on to get your views on it.
Yeah.
But there's been so much backlash. Whether you think it was ethical or not, no rules are broken. But there's been so much backlash and hate. It's almost like the women's game has taken a step back because of it, which is wrong, you know. There's loads of worse things that go on in the men's game. Football as well. It's a shame because it almost feels like they have to be perfect when that's just not life.
Yeah, no, 100%. Tonight, I'm gonna have myself a real good time. I feel alive. And the world, I'm turning inside out. Yeah. I'm floating around in ecstasy. So don't stop me now. Don't stop me. 'Cause I'm having a good time. Having a good time. A shooting star leaping through the sky. You're mindful that it's human nature sometimes, yeah. Sadly, that people are ready to pull people down. It's that tall poppy syndrome or what, you know, whatever, yeah. Space it is. And yeah. So, yeah, happy to chat about the run out between England and India.
Thank you.
It does bring up a lot of questions, doesn't it?
But just, again, diverting to the side of something that you brought up. A couple of years ago, I interviewed Lesiho Poe from South Africa. In fact, I've done a couple of interviews with her. One of the most interesting things she was talking to me was about the battle she had to not only get her foot in the door, but once the foot was in the door, then from the top to keep trying to bat away these women aren't good enough suggestions.
Yeah, and it's just funny too, because I see it at every level, whether on the board of Cricket Australia at the moment, and not to say it's happened at cricket, but I'm saying it, whether it's a governance level, or an administration level, or a playing level, or a volunteer level, is that I see incompetent men all the time, as much as I see incompetent women, but all of a sudden one woman is incompetent and they all are.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, I've seen companies fall over each and every week, and the board is full of men, and the CEO is a man, and the president's a man, and you're like, there doesn't seem to be the backlash that, oh, he's a man, he shouldn't be doing the job. Yeah. But all of a sudden, you flip that to a woman in the position, and it's a different narrative.
Yeah, it is. And for me, sometimes they put the wrong people in the wrong places because they're trying to look good. They're not doing it for the right reason. If you're good enough, it wouldn't matter to me if it was for men, for women, for white people, for black people. To me, it doesn't matter. You've got to be good. And especially in England, there's been a few bigger games, whether it be cricket, football or anything, where they probably put the wrong person in just to try and look good rather than putting the best person in. And sometimes, again, I think that puts more pressure on women, you know. Yeah. But it is good. Brings us back into another link. We're going to move on to now your second career as a commentator. You could potentially argue with your CV, you've almost matched what you did as a player, which is staggering. I mean, life must be pretty good at the moment.
I'm prepping for the T20 Men's World Cup and the Women's Big Bash at the moment.
Wow.
And I sort of giggle to myself because you're covering, like, which I think is the best women's domestic competition in the world, and, you know, an ICC Men's World Cup as well. And you're like, how did I get here? Like, it's just kind of, how did this all kind of happen? Yeah. And this is, like you say, it's my second career, but, I mean, the funny thing is in between it all, I was a PE teacher as well. I worked for Cricket Victoria in game development for 5 years.
Yeah.
I did 5 years of work with TLA Worldwide as an athlete manager as well. So, you know, I've had all these different points in between sort of the playing and now the commentating. I love that too, because it's just all these different lived experiences too, which I hope is a value add on air, because you can sort of bring in a variety of different touch points rather than just me being a player.
Exactly. And again, it goes back to the point about putting the right people in the right seats, because you have got that knowledge. As I said, you know, you talk cricket now, you know Mel Jones if you say your name, and, you know, you've got a great flow, knowledge when you commentate, which again is great for anybody who wants to become a commentator. As you said, your prior working and learning things like that is just perfect for what you're trying to do now.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. It's lovely to hear, because I think for me, I never planned on being a full-time commentator. It was purely a hobby, you know. And so when all of a sudden you're like, well, this is your full-time job, you're like, okay, you know, what is it I'm going to do? And I think a lot for me is you want the audience to leave, you know, whatever space and time they've been with you, whether it's 5 minutes as they've just flicked on to get the score, or they're sitting down for the entire day of a game. You want them to go away going, well, I learned something about the game or about broader life or whatever. So they've been sort of educated in a sense, but they've been entertained, they've had a bit of fun, but they've been engaged, and they feel as if they're almost sitting next to you in the commentary box and just having a chat, or on the couch in your lounge room, having a chat about the game as well.
That's exactly it. And that's what we get from you, Mel. And that's just me talking as an outsider. And that's exactly what we get from you, is that when something needs to be discussed, you're right in it. You tell us exactly a professional's point of view from it, rather than just commentating on the game.
Yeah, it's a balance too, because I don't know if people sort of know the commentary box for cricket, but you sort of got your lead that calls the ball and what actually happens sort of thing. And then the expert jumps in and comes in with the colour of it. And so those two roles are quite different too. So it's important that, I think, you know, anyone getting into the business is that they sort of understand those two points of difference, so that you've got two voices coming in, hopefully talking about the one incident that may have a completely different point of view. Because millions of people watch cricket, not everyone's going to see it the same way.
Exactly.
So it's nice to hear that sort of point of difference.
Yeah, fabulous. And just something you touched on, that you started off as a hobby. You started in 2001 on comms for Sky in England, but it was only one game per year, probably again because of the lack of games. And it was really 2009, you know, you hosted the ICC Women's World Cup in Sydney, 7 matches. And then later on, a few years ago, you actually became a full-time commentator, and you've really taken off since then.
Yeah, look, I've probably actually enjoyed bits and pieces all the way through until having to make that decision too, because most of it started with women's cricket. You mentioned 2001. I'd got dropped from the Aussie team, and the girls were touring England, and I was working with Surrey Cricket at the time, and Sky needed an Australian voice and someone who knew the players, so asked me, and I said no. I said, and they went, what do you mean? I went, well, why would I want to commentate on a game that I want to be playing in? That's just painful.
That's a fair point.
And they said, oh, it's 300 quid. And I said, tell me where, when, and what's when. Yeah. I was like, when was it? More than all the players were getting paid put together, because no one was getting paid a cent. And I thought, I'm going to have one up on these girls.
Perhaps this commentary laugh isn't too bad.
Yeah. It was one of those days you sort of had no idea what I was doing, and I thought, it's one game, that's it. And, you know, go back to your day job, Jones. Yeah. And then it gradually got, you know, one game to two games a year. And it just sort of, it was just a drip feeding.
Yeah.
And because of all the drip feeding, more opportunities arise for women in commentary, and more so in the men's game. It was the IPL in 2014 when they got Isha Gua, Lisa Sureka, Andrew Chopra and myself on. There was the fact that I'd done the games with Sky Sport and a few games with Channel 9 in Australia that they sort of knew that I'd commentate a little bit and, you know, won't stuff up horrendously on it. Yeah, so they gave me a shot. Yeah, it sort of took off from there to the point where I had to make a decision between work as an athlete manager and commentating full time.
Yeah, fabulous. Made the right choice, I would say. And then this year, you were part of the Sky Sports team that commentated on the English summer. That must have been special, and you'd be proud of yourself to actually do.
Yeah, massively. And Sky are an amazingly super organisation on the cricket front to work with. There's, you know, great banter in the commentary box, but also really good analysis of the game. And you've got the likes of Nasser Sain and Mark Butcher and Mike Atherton in terms of the test match side of things, throwing Kumar Sangakkara. You know, when you're off there, you're in the, you know, the breakout room and you're chatting cricket, and it's just, people would give a kidney to, you know, swap positions kind of thing. And it's a wonderful learning curve for all of us, because we all bring a different point of view to it all the time. And then you get into all the other games, the 100 and women's internationals, and you know you got the likes of Ebony Rainford-Brent, Lydia Greenway, you know, who you've played against or played with at Surrey. Sorry, this is going to sound a bit, you know, toppy, but it's, you know, it's almost a family in a sense, because you've played with each other, you've grown up watching each other. Then you get this opportunity of, you know, hopefully bringing some enjoyment to other people to come in and watch the game as well. But, you know, they're fantastic to work with. They're a really brave organisation to talk about things outside of cricket as well. They gave Mikey Holding and Ebbs the platform to talk about Black Lives Matter a couple of years ago. So you know that they're an organisation that care about the individual and want to make it as inclusive as they possibly can as well, which is lovely.
Yeah, fabulous. You know, and just talking back to when you said it was a bit soppy, but you can all relate back to when you were playing and how much better it is now. You know, that obviously gives you that insight and probably fuels your passion a little bit more to really push the game on.
Yeah, like, I never want to be one of those people saying, oh, back in my day, you know, because you get the old eye roll going, you really are old now, Jones, you know. But it's nice for people to know where the game has come from and the gains it made. And, you know, we had the wonderful moment at Lord's during the test match where the Rachel Hayhoe Flint gates were opened for the very first time. And she was an icon and a pioneer and a trailblazer, all those words of our game, yet still not a lot of people know about her. But now all of a sudden, the imagery of the gates at Lord's that were closed to women for, you know, hundreds of years.
Absolutely.
She pushed for membership in the MCC for women, and now these gates are open to literally every demographic.
Wow, Mel, absolutely fantastic. Your interviews are amazing. And after a quick break, it's our SLB Sports Roundup.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Nagging pain. We at Alka-Seltzer know that a small amount of the patient's own bone marrow and blood cells can treat many painful conditions with regenerative orthopedic therapy. This is an attractive treatment option for painful joints, back pain, sports injuries and many other conditions. It may avoid the need for surgery altogether. Alka-Seltzer, part of a network of 50 RegenX clinics worldwide where over 60,000 patients have been treated and helped. Alka-Seltzer. Life is more beautiful with less pain.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
We finish this week with our famous SLB Sports Roundup featuring golf, horse racing, cricket, darts, NBA, NFL and football. Darts, it was the DPW Tour and the Australian PGA Championship held at the Royal Queensland Golf Course. It was won by Liv Stowaway, Cam Smith on 14 under par in his native country. Three shots clear of joint second, Jason Scrivener and Rio Hizatsani. They also held the Joburg Open in South Africa using the Houghton Golf Course. And that was won by Dan Bradbury, minus 21. Sam Vallimäki was second, three shots back on minus 18, with a further shot back to joint third, Christian Bezu and Daniel Van Tonder. This week, again, there's two sides to the DP World Tour. The ISPS Australia Open from the Victoria Golf Course and the South African Open from the Gary Player Golf Course. The LET, the Ladies European Tour, held their final event of the season with the Andalusia Open de España from Benjavís. It was won in a playoff by German Caroline Hedwell. She finished on minus 18, joint with Morgan Mitrasse, and Caroline Hedwell won the playoff. Third place was Swedish star Lynn Grant, one further back on minus 17. Horse racing, some results to bring you from last weekend. Well, we hit the board, but we didn't get in the winner's enclosure with the Coral Gold Cup. Three of our long-term anti-post fancies finished second, third and fourth. Remastered and Jericho Rock from the David Pipe Yard and Cora Gramble, who come from a mile back, could be a Grand National horse to finish fourth. It was won by Dan and Harry Skelton's Le Milos, who improved a lot from his banger win earlier in the season and took the race in fine and battling style. Stage Star, who we were looking forward to see over fences, got beaten, but McFabulous won, turning over the odds on favourite. The Rehearsal Chase, as indicated by us last week, was won by L'Empresse, held at Newcastle, for Venetia Williams and Charlie Deutsch. And the Fighting Fifth Hurdle, again, as we expected, was won by Constitution Hill, beating his stablemate Epitante easily. The Japan Cup, the highlight of the year in Japan, was won by British jockey Ryan Moore aboard Vela Azul. And some races for you to look out for this weekend at Aintree. It's the Beecher Chase over those famous national fences. Last week we told you to look out for Geskill, Hill 16 and Snow Leopardess. And it's also the Tingle Creek Chase, which we're now putting forward Shiskin. We think if he turns up, he'll win. But if he doesn't, Edward Stone or Fernie Hollow if he runs. The 10th of December sees a return to Cheltenham for the December Gold Cup. And we're going to put up two horses we have before who've run well at Cheltenham, Il Redito and Al Dancer. On to cricket, and England, as we mentioned, travel to Pakistan. And the first test starts this week, the first test of three. And it's held at the Pindi Cricket Stadium in Rawalpindi. Darts, and it was the PDC Players Championship from Minehead, and it was won by potentially the best player ever to have played the game, Michael Van Gerwen. He beat Rob Cross 11-6 and included a 9-dart finish and a big fish, the 170 checkout in the final. They now move on to the Ali Pali for Christmas for the World Championships. NBA and some featured results from last week. Thunder 119, Knicks 129, Bucks 119, Trailblazers 111, Bulls 121, Celtics 107, Clippers 121, Jazz 114, 76ers 115, the Nets 106, Suns 115, Lakers 105, Cavaliers 114, Trailblazers 96, Hawks 115, Kings 106, Celtics 125, Mavericks 112, Raptors 98, Nets 112, Bucks 113, Bulls 118, Jazz 116, Pistons 125, Golden State Warriors 124, Clippers 107, Bucks 117, Cavaliers 102, Celtics 122, Kings 104, Spurs 94, Lakers 105, Suns 108, Pistons 102, Golden State Warriors 129, Jazz 118, Spurs 138, Lakers 143, Suns 113, Jazz 112, Nets 111, Trailblazers 97, Timberwolves 114, Golden State Warriors 137, Pistons 94, Cavaliers 102, Celtics 130, Wizards 121, Knicks 123, Grizzlies 127, and Bucks 124, the Mavericks 115. Well, the conferences again will give you the top 10. The Celtics lead the way in the East on 16-4. The Bucks are second on 14-5. The Cavs are 13-7. The Pacers are 11-8. The Hawks and 76ers are tied 5th on 11-9, and the Raptors are 7th on 10-9. Wizards are 8th on 10-10, and tied 9th are the Nets and the Heat on 10-11. And the West is led by the Suns on 13-6, closely followed by the Nuggets on 12-7, then the Grizzlies on 12-8. The Pelicans are 4th on 11-8, followed by the Clippers in 9th on 12-9. The Kings are 10-8. The Trailblazers are 11-9. The Jazz are 12-10. The Golden State Warriors get back into the top 10 and are 9th on 11-10. And the Timberwolves are 10-10. Some highlighted fixtures for this week. The 76ers play the Hawks. The Nets play the Magic. Celtics versus Hornets. Raptors versus the Cavs. Jazz versus the Bulls. Kings versus the Suns. Lakers versus the Pacers. Pistons versus the Knicks. Mavericks versus Golden State Warriors. Trailblazers versus the Clippers. Cavaliers versus 76ers, Celtics versus the Heat, Nets versus the Wizards, Knicks versus the Bucks, Suns versus the Bulls, Nuggets versus the Rockets, Jazz versus the Clippers, Lakers versus the Trailblazers, Nets versus the Raptors, Bucks versus the Lakers, Celtics versus the Heat, Golden State Warriors versus the Bulls, Knicks versus the Mavericks, Hornets versus the Bucks, Spurs versus the Suns, Pelicans versus the Nuggets, Wizards versus the Lakers, Knicks versus the Cavaliers, Nets versus the Celtics, and Magic versus the Bucks. On to NFL. Week 11's result from last weekend was Cardinals 10, 49ers 38. Weekday 12's results this weekend, Lions 25, Bulls 28, Cowboys 28, Giants 20, Vikings 33, Patriots 26, Dolphins 30, Texans 15, Titans 16, Bengals 20, Panthers 23, Broncos 10, Jets 31, Bears 10, Commanders 19, Falcons 13. Browns 23, Buccaneers 17, Jaguars 28, Ravens 27, Seahawks 34, Raiders 40, Cardinals 24, Chargers 25, 49ers 13, Saints 0, Chiefs 26, Rams 10, Eagles 40, the Packers 33. And the results to bring you next week are the Colts versus the Steelers. Well, the divisions, the AFC and the NFC are as follows. Highlighted top and bottom are Chiefs on 9-2 in the AFC and the Texans on 1-9-1. And in the NFC, the Eagles are 10-1 and the Bears are 3-9. And a breakdown in the AFC. In the East, the Dolphins and the Bills are 8-3. Jets are 7-4 and the Patriots are 6-5. What a great division, and two of those teams will probably miss out. In the West, the Chiefs are 9-2. And in the North, the Ravens and the Bengals are 7-4. In the South, the Titans are 7-4, with those Texans on 1-9-1. In the NFC, the East, again, it's the best division of the conference. The Eagles are 10-1. The Cowboys are 8-3 and the Giants are 7-4. The West see the 49ers leading the way on 7-4, and the North, the Vikings are 9-2, with the Bears 3-9. The South sees the Buccaneers leading the way on 5-6. Again, still the only division with a negative aggregate that's leading the way. Week 13's fixtures, Patriots versus the Bills, Bears versus the Packers, Falcons versus the Steelers, Vikings versus the Jets, Lions versus the Jaguars, Eagles versus the Titans, Texans versus the Browns, Giants versus the Commanders, Ravens versus the Broncos, 49ers versus the Dolphins, Rams versus the Seahawks, Raiders versus the Chargers, Bengals versus the Chiefs, Cowboys versus the Colts, and the Buccaneers take on the Saints. We finish off with football and we start with the WSL, match day 9, and the fixtures are as follows. Manchester United versus Aston Villa, Arsenal versus Everton, Leicester versus Chelsea, Reading versus Tottenham, Manchester City versus Brighton, Liverpool versus West Ham. The league 1-2-3 are as follows. Chelsea are on top, they've played 8 and have 21 points. Arsenal and Manchester United are second and third. Both played 7. Both have 18 points. But Arsenal have the better goal difference, plus 16, to Manchester United's plus 13. Well, the World Cup is underway, and with two games played in every league apart from groups G and H, this is how it stands. In Group A, the Netherlands have 4 points, Ecuador have 4 points, Senegal have 3, Qatar, the hosts, have none, and become the first hosts to go out after just two games in the league's process. England lead Group B on 4 points, with Iran on 3, USA 2, Wales 1. Group C is led by Poland on 4. Argentina had a surprise defeat in their first game there on 3. Saudi Arabia 3, Mexico 1. Group D sees France, the only team that's unbeaten or haven't dropped a point, on 6 points. Australia 3, Denmark 1 and Tunisia 1. Spain lead Group E on 4 points from Japan and Costa Rica, both with 3, and Germany, the surprise package, with 1 point. Group F are led by Croatia and Morocco on 4, Belgium with 3, Canada, who are already out, with 0. One game has been played in groups G and H. Brazil lead Group G on 3 points with Switzerland, Cameroon and Serbia have 1 point. And Portugal and South Korea lead the way in Group H, Portugal on 3, South Korea 1, Uruguay 1 and Ghana on 0. So what does it mean going forward for the last games? The Netherlands, if they avoid defeat, they qualify. Ecuador and Senegal, the winner takes all. Group B, if England avoid defeat by 4 goals, they're through. And that would mean a winner takes all shootout between Iran and USA. Iran win or draw sees them through, and only a win for the USA would see them qualify. Group C, it's a winner takes all potentially between Poland and Argentina, even though they top the group at the moment. If Saudi Arabia beat Mexico, then they qualify. Group D sees France, obviously who have already qualified. If they draw or beat Tunisia, that means Australia would need to avoid defeat by Denmark to go through in second place. Group E, Spain or Japan win against each other, they qualify. The loser means they may lose out to Costa Rica or Germany, whichever one wins that game. Group F, Croatia and Morocco. If they both win, they qualify, as simple as that. And despite only one game being held, the favourites won their first games. If Brazil and Portugal continue their form, they should qualify as well. That's our SLB Sports Roundup. Well, everybody, thank you very much. What a great show. We hope you enjoyed listening again from Mel Jones. We've got our brilliant SLB Sports Roundup, and it's the first show of December, the month of Christmas and the last month of 2022 already. Thank you to the listeners for tuning in. We really, really appreciate your support. Thanks also to Mel Jones, best commentator there is around. She's so brilliant and so unbiased and knowledgeable. And of course to Johan, Rafaela and the team at UK Off Radio for giving us this great platform. Happy December, everybody, and we'll see you next week.